Steve, thanks very much. It's Bill Leff along with Andrea Darlis. Andrea is sitting in for Wendy, who will return tomorrow. On the phone line with us is Tom Mikaitis. Tom is a professor of history at DePaul University right here in Chicago and a terrorism analyst here to discuss some of what we'll be talking about. Here to discuss what happened yesterday. But he's not on the line quite yet, Kevin. We still loading him up? Okay. We'll give it just a minute or two. One of the things I want to ask him, because I'm very unclear on this, but it came up yesterday while I was watching the various news sources, is they were trying to determine whether or not what happened was a hate crime, an act of terrorism, or both.
Or both.
And I'm not positive I know what the differentiation is between those.
Yeah, we'll have to ask.
He's on, Kevin. He's good.
Good.
Tom, thank you for being here. I just introduced you, of course, a professor of history at DePaul, terrorism expert. We do appreciate your time on this, Tom. I just said to Andrea, what is the difference? They were trying to determine yesterday if this was a hate crime or an act of terrorism or potentially both. Do we know the difference in those classifications?
Acts of terrorism are almost by definition hate crime. But in this case, when you focus on a particular marginalized group, typically the Islamists have been content with, prefer mass casualty events directed at the general population of the United States. This, however, was a more focused attack on a group of individuals, although I think we all need to say an attack on one of us is an attack on all of us. But he targeted this particular group. I also think there's a personal pathology going on here, not more so than even a terrorist ideology.
Tom, this is in no way criticizing the response of the Orlando Police Department, but I'm just curious, what are the procedures and the protocol for it? It took them several hours to respond and to move in. Why is that? Can you kind of explain
that? I can tell you that. And the thing is, and I think you're right not to criticize them, we don't know the full details of the situation. The wisdom in any kind of hostage situation has typically been, as long as there's no shooting going on, the individuals wanting to negotiate, you basically contain and hold and then do that negotiation. Because the object is at that point is to get as many people, including the shooter, ironically, out of the situation alive. So they were talking to him, and if he's talking, he's not shooting. So I think what they probably determined is, again, they don't know, they don't have eyes inside the place. So what they were probably doing was having a conversation with him. They said that, and that he was calm and things like that, they claim. But on the other hand, he wasn't clear what he was asking for either. Now, something must have changed. There must have been something that led them to believe that either he was about to fire again, or who knows, he may have been fired. We don't know. But they then decided they had to go in and accept the risk to the hostages by storming the place. So I don't, and I'm clear, I'm not an expert on SWAT tactics, but on the other hand, everything I've seen says that they handled it as well as they could have.
Tom, you alluded just a few seconds ago to what he may or may not have been asking for. That's usually a component in a situation like this. There's some sort of demands, right?
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying. The thing is, this is so reminiscent to me of Anders Breivik in Norway, because you have an individual who clearly appears to be disturbed, latching on to an ideology. Same thing happened in Colorado Springs with the man who went in with another AR-15 to a Planned Parenthood clinic and, was rambling about no more dead babies. But on the other hand, clearly was clinically disturbed. So I think that's going on here. If you look at his photos that he's tweeting and his behaviors, no sign of increased religiosity, no increased devotion, no growing a beard, he seems, and his ex-wife was saying not only was he abusive, but he was abusive in an erratic kind of way. She didn't know, why he would hit her and things of that, apparently. And his family said, we didn't see any signs of being more religious. The mosque said, we don't have any real contact with him on this. So I really think this is driven by his own internal kind of dynamic. And he happened, obviously, as a Muslim, he focused on that particular radical ideology and made that the lightning rod.
So, Tom, we were questioning beforehand, and I think since the beginning, when we found out that the FBI had questioned him twice and didn't find enough information or enough credibility to put him on a, quote, watch list, how come? I mean, what has to constitute?
I don't know. Yeah, that's a question I've been fielding all morning. Yeah, and I don't really know what exactly he said, unhealthy interest in, and I think that's what it was. It was about comments he was making. They might have determined, and again, there's a certain, I'm speculating here, you know, that his activity online was disturbing and so on. But unless he's crossed the line, or unless, you know, and again, they have a lot of people they got to watch, you know, unless he's crossed a particular line, met a certain threshold, they must have made their determination. Now, when they do this twice, I'm very leery. And I don't think there was connection between that and the abuse of the spouse. Now, there was no charge in the abuse of the spouse, but there was still a report. But I'm kind of wondering if somebody had put all those pieces together, at the very least, they might have been able to say, you know what, you can't have a gun until we do a more thorough background check. Unfortunately, the watch list and the FBI investigation is federal. All the gun laws in this kind are state to state, and that's a huge problem.
Tom, they made mention, the ex-wife did anyway, at her press conference, that when she first met him and in the early stages of their relationship, he was extremely normal, and then there was some sort of a switch that flipped, and he became a much more hot-tempered person. Is that something that's majorly significant in this case, do you think?
You have to ask a mental health expert, but that's indicative. I think what she herself used the word bipolar, and I'm not qualified to make that determination. But as I look at all the pieces, this suggests a personal pathology, not a typical ISIS thing. Now, what's confusing is his profile: first generation, born in the U.S., you know, Afghani parents, you know, not being sort of in this kind of no man's land. But on the other hand, the evidence was he had a good job. He worked for a security firm. He seems to have developed this healthy relationship, and then something changed. Now, again, you should talk to somebody in the mental health field and ask him, is this typical of a personality disorder, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder? I'm not qualified to say that. But the point is, all of the signs are pointing to something going on in his head rather than his, what we call the typical radicalization, where he's becoming more devout, and at some point somebody latches on to him and radicalizes him by persuading him that, well, you really need to join. It's not enough to be devout. You have to join this organization, strike a blow on behalf of the cause. That doesn't seem to have happened.
Tom, you study this, you analyze this, and I don't mean this to be a morbid question, but I think it's just the society in which we live today. Mm-hmm. If we're ever in a situation, God forbid, you know, in somewhere we think is a safe zone and something happens, should we run? Do we hide? Or I know there's a lot of people who might want to try and play hero and take the suspect down. What are we encouraged to do?
You know, that's not a morbid question. That's a healthy question, and I really wish more people would ask it, because there are things you can do. There's something called shelter in place. I go through it with my students in a classroom. I'm not trying to scare you, but here's what we're going to do in the event that I get an announcement of an active shooter, that shelter in place is the thing you do until you're sure you can move safely. That's what the people in the bathroom did. You know, it means staying low, staying out of sight, putting your phone on vibrate. This is not the time to be tweeting your friends, hey, I'm in the middle of a shootout. Isn't this cool? Not a good idea. You don't want to, and they're going to try to call you. So if you don't have your phone on vibrate, you don't want to turn it off, because you might be able to get information out. But if it's going to ring, it just draws attention to you. So, you know, if you can't actually get out through the exits, as some people did, you know, finding a safe place, being, you know, down and low and quiet, not drawing attention to yourself is something you can do. And as I said, there were two bathrooms, and one of them were about 20 people who survived, precisely because somehow, I don't know if they barricaded themselves or they just hid, they managed to. Okay. It's a case-by-case thing, you know, running, you know, if you can get away, if you know somebody coming in one door and you're going out the other, that might work. In other cases, you don't know whether you're actually, if you don't know where the shooter is, then that's not a particularly good strategy, because you could be running right in to the target area. In this case, the people were wise who got out the back, but not everybody can. I mean, there's only so many doors, even in a fire safe code, in which it sounds like this was a pretty safe environment, and there was a guard at the door. You know, it's just, there's no such thing as absolute security. But that's a really, that people need to think about that more. Be aware of your surroundings.
I know this is an extreme, but I'd be afraid in that barricading myself in a bathroom situation that you could potentially hear people on the outside wanting to come in and join you, and then you're thinking, do I know that this is legit? Could this possibly be the shooter? Who do I let in? Who do I not let in? There's so much happening in such a quick burst of time.
And I can't answer that question. It's a case-by-case, individual-by-individual situation that you would just have to assess to the best of your knowledge.
Tom, there's other questions that we have for you. Are you okay on time? Do you have a couple more minutes with us?
I'm fine. No, yeah, I have no time pressure at all.
Tom Mikitas is with us, professor of history at DePaul University right here in Chicago, and a terrorism analyst. If you have any questions or comments, 312-981-7200. It's Bill F. and Andre Darlis sitting in for Wendy on WGN. Tom Mikitas is our guest. It's Bill F. and Andre Darlis sitting in for Wendy Snyder. Tom is a professor of history at DePaul University right here in Chicago and a terrorism analyst. Tom, here's a question that I brought up earlier with Andrea and with Steve Bertrand in the newsroom. As of yesterday, on ISIS's webpage, they made mention of the events that took place in Orlando, but they didn't fully claim the events. They just made mention of them. How is this advantageous or not for them?
Well, they're going to mention and bless any attack of this style, and if it's to their, it's always to their advantage to claim that they're behind it, even because, of course, they want us to believe they can hit us whenever, wherever they choose, which is not the case. And so, if you're, and the other is they welcome fellow travelers. You don't have to be a formal member. You strike a blow in the interest of the cause, we'll celebrate it. So, you know, this is grist for their mill. There's no question about that. Their targeting has been, you know, not, it's interesting. ISIS is not targeted symbolically in the sense of they have not, like, say, targeted a gay nightclub or something like that. The concert venue in Paris was just a target because it had a large concentration of people in a very compacted space, a confined space, and made it much easier to kill them. Same with the soccer stadium. But this, that's why I say this guy seemed to have gotten really upset about this. Just someone in his family said he'd seen two men kissing and he got very angry at it and so on. But that seems to be what was going on here.
It doesn't seem like ISIS really cares who dies as long as people die.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, with the Paris.
Yeah.
With the Paris nightclub.
Yeah, exactly. That's the bitter irony of religiously motivated terrorism. You know, kill them all, let God sort them out. I mean, during the way back in 1998, Al-Qaeda, some of the captured people from the Tanzania bombing in East Africa, the Twin Embassy bombings, they interviewed the guy and they said, didn't you know that because of all the Muslim you know, employees, civilian employees, that you'd kill a lot of them too? He goes, oh, yeah, we were told that. But if they were in the right relationship with God, they'd go to paradise. If not, you know, they'd suffer the consequences. Well, if that's your mentality, there simply is no moderation. They just, I mean, we've seen what they do to what they've done to their prisoners, the massacre of, you know, the murder and rape of Yazidis, the murder of the Shia. I mean, there just is no moderation. But again, I think this is something personally set this guy off and focused him on this target.
Tom, I know that as we speak, investigators are trying to determine exactly what part he, the shooter, played in any terrorist group. So once we have that information, whether he is fully invested in a terrorism group or not, what do we do with that information?
Yeah, the thing is that this is something, you know, when I started working on counterterrorism for, you know, through the U.S. government, actually, I've been studying it long before, but around 2002, we were very focused on you destroy the group, you degrade the organization, you eliminate the leaders, this kind of decapitation operations, you know, you contain their ability to operate. We're now much more focused on countering radicalization, saying, let's try and figure out what attracts people to organizations and then see if we can counter it. And the thing there, of course, is you think in, you know, in kind of inoculation terms, who's the vulnerable population and how do we vaccinate them? And part of that means, you know, getting with educators, leaders in religious communities, family members, you know, counselors, everybody to say, much as we would with a person with an alcohol or drug abuse problem, hey, we need to do an intervention here. They've done some of that in the Twin Cities with the Somali population. There was a man who returned from ISIS, an American man. It was on TV. I think it was Channel 5 a couple weeks back, and they're using him to try, and he said, hey, it's not what I thought it was. You know, guy, and they use that information, put it out on the web, and say, hey, look, you're being lied to. But the other is they interview him and say, help us understand how you got hooked, and so we can get in there and counter it. you know, because a lot of it takes place, you know, there's a human contact, but it's often through, you know, encrypted means on the web. It may be their equivalent of Skype or Google Hangouts and so on, as well as through dark websites and chat rooms. And we're trying to figure that out and kind of get in there and interdict it.
Tom, we appreciate your knowledge on this, your expertise on this. Really quick, because we only have a couple of seconds, did anything about you, other than the obvious that 50 people died and 53 more were injured, did anything just out and out shock you about what went down yesterday?
Even when I do this, I don't completely lose the ability to be shocked. I was, you know, struck by the extent of it, as you said. And then the more that emerged in a very odd sort of way, I was a bit relieved because it does not have the hallmarks of Brussels, San Bernardino, or Paris. Does not appear to be a sophisticated plot. This appears to be a random actor, a lone wolf, acting out of a pathology that latched onto an ideology and focuses anger in a particular direction. Strange as it may seem, horrific as it is, it does mean that we don't look to see a bunch of, you know, of a cell of people trying to do the same thing. We worry about copycats, but right, not people directly connected to him.
Tom, again, we appreciate it. Thank you so much for your time today. It's Tom Mikaitis, professor of history at DePaul University here in Chicago and a terrorism analyst. We'll take a quick break and then the news from Kim Gordon. It's Bill and Andrea in for Wendy on WGN.